The next case of the day, then, is Lambert versus Lincoln Public Schools. Mr. Weiss, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice.
Let's give everybody, we've got some folks coming in and out, so let's give them a second to do that. And I think we've accomplished that, so you may proceed.
Thank you. Again, my name is John Weiss. I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case, Olivia and Jenna Lambert. I think that this is an interesting case that involves trying to decide or define the duty of a school or school district providing reasonable care and safe premises for individuals that come onto that property. In April of 2016, Olivia Lambert was a kindergartner at Sheridan Elementary School in Lincoln. Her mother, Jenna, came to the school at closing time, at dismissal time, 3:38 in the afternoon, to pick up Olivia. She gets Olivia from one of the dismissal doors of the school. They walk to a playground that is still located on the school property. Olivia begins to play with another student, classmate of hers, on the playground, while her mother sits on a bench just across the way, probably 30 feet away, and discusses with another parent, I think the parent of the child that Olivia was playing with, their planning for a after school activity that's going to take place sometime in the future. While they are sitting there and while Olivia is playing, the defendants Griffins bring their pit bull dog to the playground. The dog ends up grabbing Olivia by her left hand.
And what was the, when did that actually happen? What was the amount of time between dismissal and that happening, and is that relevant?
I think that it is relevant. The actual time, and the record isn't clear. Nobody knows exactly when the dog bit Olivia. What we know as far as the time frame is concerned is that school was dismissed at 3:38 p.m., that Jenna Lambert, Olivia's mother, made a 911 call at 4:32 p.m. So the dog bite happened, obviously, between 3:40 and 4:30.
Does that imply that there's about an hour time has elapsed?
Actually, with respect, Your Honor, I would say that it's less than an hour. I would say that it's probably closer to a half hour, if you really think about it. Olivia was dragged around the playground by the pit.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but before you go on to your next point,
yes,
is the record undisputed that the dog bite occurred after the school day had ended and the child had been released to her mother?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question and why we're here. What you asked me was, did it happen after the school day had ended? And that really is one of the core issues in this appeal. What is the school day?
Well, let's break it down a little bit. The question was, when did this occur? After the school day, was a child released to her mother? So let's start with the second part of the question. Had the child been released to her mother yet?
Yes. They had not left the school grounds. But, and during this same period of time, and I understand the issue, I understand why we're asking that question. Does the school district have a duty to protect people and keep their premises reasonably safe after dismissal? Is there some kind of a time period that's involved? And my argument is that while there are still people and staff on the premises, that triggers the duty of the school or the school district. It may not be at 7 o'clock at night if there's no ongoing activities at that period of time, but it could be if there was an after school choir or musical event that would require people coming onto the premises.
Why isn't it a discretionary function, the decision on whether or not to supervise a playground after the school day has ended?
I think that the discretionary function of the school district was deciding that there should be a no dogs allowed policy. Now remember, the evidence in this case suggests, one, that there is a policy, now, and there is dispute about these facts as well. The policy itself, as written, says no dogs allowed that are not leashed, are not under control. The actions of the staff, primarily the principal of Sheridan Elementary, and from the testimony of Ms. Lammers, who is another teacher, clearly indicated that that was not what they thought the policy was. That was not how they affected the policy's enforcement. It was any dog that showed up. When that did happen, and it did happen on occasions, they would talk to whoever was in control of the dog and say, would you please, you can't have your dog on school grounds. Would you please take it off? And they complied.
I want to ask you what you think the source of your claim is, or if there's some confusion about that. You've used both the word premises and you've used the word the connection of the school to a student. Is the liability that you're seeking to impose based upon premises liability, which would apply to anyone who's on that school ground at that time and under those circumstances, or is it based upon the child's status as a student and the relationship between the school in that capacity?
And I struggled with this in the briefing, because I think, in all honesty, it really probably is both or dependent upon the individual that you're talking about. Remember, this is a school, right? So you have students, right? That's the obvious relationship between the school and a student.
Well, let's suppose instead of occurring after a school day, this happens on Saturday when nobody's in the business. You wouldn't be claiming then the special relationship between the school and the child.
No, sir.
It would be purely a premises-based argument.
Correct.
So what makes this situation different, given that we know classes were ended and the child had been returned from the custody of the school to her parent?
Because even though classroom instruction had ended, the activities of the school had not. There were still other children that were on the playground in addition to my client, Olivia. There was after school club activities that were going on at the premises, in the school building.
After school activities going on inside the building or outside?
This is not clear from the record, but my understanding is it could be both. Primarily, it was inside of the building, but there were, in terms of some of the science clubs, they had an outdoor kind of area where they could take kids to find bugs.
Was your client involved, or the child involved in that activity?
No.
And it,
but I don't think that that absolves the school district from having
Council, I'm sorry to interrupt. Were any LPS employees involved in the after-school activities?
Yes. The staff, those after-school club activities were primarily run by teachers.
Were they acting in their capacity as LPS teachers, or were they being paid through the PTO?
They were being paid by the PTO. I still think that because you're talking about staff, LPS staff and LPS students on LPS property engaging in educational activities, that takes away this discretion or this argument that just because they're paid by the PTO doesn't mean
that the school district
should.
Is there anything in the record to show that there was or was not aftercare at that school?
There is, and there was aftercare. That was being provided in addition to the after-school activities.
So how long are you asking us to stretch the school day under your theory? Is it to dinner time? Is it beyond dinner time? Is it till the last child leaves the school building? What are you asking us to hold?
Yes, I think as long as there is staff present and students present, that the school district still has that responsibility. And I do believe that it is an aspect of this case to involve the premises liability, because as long as there's students there, there are people who are going to be coming to pick up those students. Remember, the evidence from Ms. Lammers was that kids would or there would be parents that would call into the office to say, I'm running late, I'm running behind, I'm not going to be there at 3:40 or 4 o'clock. It's going to be 5 o'clock before I can get there to pick up my kid.
Who provided?
And they would keep the student
in their
custody.
Pardon me, who provided the aftercare? Does the record show?
I'm sorry?
Does the record show who provided the aftercare? Who were the personnel? How were they paid?
I honestly don't remember. I believe that the record before this court is that from Dr. Curran's testimony, that she testified that there was aftercare services that were provided for the children. I honestly can't remember whether there was a lease that was that we obtained through discovery, but I'm not sure if that was made part of the record.
I want to be clear about your argument as to the premises. To return to my hypothetical of a Saturday event, is your argument that a child who happens to be a student at that school who's on the grounds on Saturday would have a claim, but someone else who's not a student would not?
I would say that the realistic approach to this would be whether or not there is staff on site at that Saturday. Presumably, there isn't going to be any staff, and so if there's a child...
Is that a discretionary function? A discretionary function exception?
I think in this case, the fact that they enacted a policy of no dogs and they began to enforce it, and they don't have any policy that says when we're not going to enforce it, when we are not going to provide this type of supervision, that is, according to that Norman versus Ogallala case, that is not a planning but an execution failure.
Is the decision how and when to staff the playground a discretionary decision?
I think that's operational.
All right.
I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schauer, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. May it please the court, my name is Josh Schauer, here on behalf of the Appalachian League of Public Schools. I just want to touch on a few things here. I think the court has highlighted the primary issues and matters that we face here. The record is extremely clear that there was an after-school club or clubs occurring that day, and the record is crystal clear that those were not LPS employees at that time. The evidence is absolutely undisputed that they were not paid by LPS. There was no connection to LPS. The record is extremely clear in that regard. And I don't know of any indication one way or the other that simply having staff in the building, whatever that means, you know, in the building, what if that staff person, if one staff person decides to stay and play solitaire on his or her computer until 10 at night, you know, that sort of thing, that staff in the building would have no relevance or, you know, indication that there's anything going on with regard to any duty to supervise the playground.
What does the record show with respect not to the activities but aftercare?
Thank you, Your Honor. There is no evidence that there is aftercare occurring. The only evidence is after school clubs. There's no evidence of any aftercare occurring at Sheridan either that day or in general. Yes. And with regard to, you know, occasionally having to tell someone, the principal or another teacher having to tell someone to remove his or her dog or dress dogs, the evidence is undisputed that occurred during the school day, right? Before dismissal or at dismissal time, they would have to maybe approach a grandparent, I think was an example, or somebody who had a new puppy and was excited to bring that And it was occurring at that dismissal time between the 3:38 bell and 3:45 when teachers were done with their duties and leaving. And if it occurred at that time, yes, they may occasionally tell someone at that time to, you know, keep the dog away from students, but that's a far cry from the situation we're addressing here.
What is the actual written policy in regard to dogs? What does it say?
Yeah, at this time, it copied the Lincoln Municipal Code, which said that dogs are allowed so long as they are under control, essentially on a leash or in a kennel or in a vehicle. And that's
what
all
there
was.
What does the signage say? Does it contradict that?
The sign had a simple sort of the Ghostbuster sign, right? The dog with the slash through it that had been faded. And the indication there was, as indicated by the policy analyst or the policy administrator for LPS, reading those together, that was no dogs generally during the school day, and that the policy about dogs under control, on leash, whatever else, was after school hours, right? To read those together, to let people know, hey, during the school day, please keep your dogs away, but we do have this policy, it is a playground, it is a public park. After those school hours, you know, that's allowed. So there's no contradiction, it's just sort of reading them together. And you know, there's also the provision, of course, in a policy that talked about, you know, service animals and things like that are allowed. So clearly, you know, the Ghostbuster dog sign was not an absolute prohibition on dogs or certain animals on
is all this grounds. Written down somewhere, or is this sort of hopeful that people will put all of this information together?
The policies regarding having the dogs leashed is a written policy, a regulation. The policy about service animals is written, but there was nothing else about, there was no statement at that time that during school hours, dogs are not allowed.
Did the sign have any times on it, the posted sign?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Where was the sign located with respect to the dog bite that we're here to talk about?
Not near the area. There was a couple. It's a big campus, as you can imagine. I can't recall if that campus was in evidence or not, but it was, I don't know the exact distance, but it was, in my estimation, not close to the area at issue.
Does our record tell us where, in relationship to the incident, the sign was?
Yes, there is deposition testimony where I think both the plaintiff and Dr. Curran, the principal, agree generally where the incident occurred and where the signs were located.
Thank you.
But again, I think the signs are just, you know, part of that, reading everything together, and as indicated by the evidence, that they did address that during the school day. And I think as indicated by the question about, you know, Saturday afternoon, right? So those signs, in theory, are present Saturday afternoon with the Ghostbuster sign of dogs, but there is no expectation, I would imagine, that anybody's arguing or asserting that anybody would expect that on that Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock that somebody would be there to, you know, enforce that or whatever that means. It's a clear indication that it's to apply while students are at school, and the other policy is the one where, say, if they're just not allowed to be at large, we need to be leashed or kenneled.
So why is this episode? Why is this a discretionary policy to the extent we can figure out what the policy is?
So the policy generally is that no dogs during school days with the with the exception of service animals. And then the other policy is, hey, they can be there at school hours so long as they are leashed or under control. And then the policy is how, or the discretionary function is, how is that to be enforced? You know, the record is that the teacher's day ends at 3:45. Do they need to shuffle some time or money around then to supervise, you know, until 4 o'clock, until 4:30 on Saturdays, on Sundays, you know, into the evening? That's a discretionary function, is they have this policy, but, you know, how is it to be enforced or staffed by the school district? And the discretion they exercised was based on, look, I've got staff that after dismissal needs to do other things, might need to be in the building, might need to go somewhere else, might have another job. We're not going to supervise this area after school hours, is a discretionary function.
Could you remind us how this would have ensued had it been, say, during what everybody agrees would be the school day, and the children are all at their desks, right? And,
right.
In that case, someone's in the playground, and then somebody else comes with a dog.
Yep. There are a number of different ways that it was discussed on the record that could be handled, depending on, you know, when it occurred. If it was during recess and there are kids around and somebody
but
has...
But in my case, nobody else is out there in the playground. It's like neighborhood people
sure
coming into an open playground.
Sure. And I think the indication was there would be an assessment of, you know, was it a threat if somebody saw, hey, all the kids are in the building, but we see somebody out there at 2 o'clock with the dog. You know, it would be an assessment. Is there a threat? There's testimony about potentially calling the LPS director of security, Joe Wright, if it looked like a dog that was potentially not under control, or maybe it could be a threat to somebody. Then that it could be a call to the director of security. It could be having an administrator walk out there and asking that person to please remove his dog during school hours.
Given that we must view on summary judgment the evidence in the light most favorable to your opponent, is there an issue of fact about whether this event occurred before or after 3:45? Which seems to be a seminal time in your analysis?
There is not, Your Honor. And there's a number of different ways to look at that. I think one is from the perspective of the Griffins, right? The record, her testimony, Ms. Griffin's deposition testimony is she picked up her own children at Sheridan, then drove to her home, gathered up her family, gathered up the dog, then drove back to Sheridan and found no issues with parking. Her testimony is clear that, hey, it was easy to find parking, and that's not going to occur at or near school time. So we've got her picking up her kids, going home, driving back, and then proceeding to walk the dog, I believe. Her testimony is for approximately 10 minutes before it does its business. And, you know, she tries to find a bag, which takes a few more minutes, and then hands the leash to her young son. And we don't know exactly what the time frame there is. So there, I think that undisputed evidence clearly gets us past that 3:45 time frame. We also have the undisputed evidence that the 911 call was placed at 4:32 and the crew arrived at about 4:37.
There's some testimony by your opponent that there was an attempt to enlist assistance from inside the building.
Correct.
And that delayed the time of the 911 call, right?
Sure. But that testimony is that person essentially went right from the scene to try to get assistance from the building and found that door locked. And that door, the evidence reflects, locks at 4:30. So if that person left at or around the time of the incident and got to the door and it was already locked, and the undisputed evidence is that the door locks at 4:30, that would indicate the incident at issue occurred at or around 4:30, consistent with the time the 911 call was made.
There have been some questions about the nature of the way in which this negligence claim has been framed. Is it a premises liability claim? Is it a claim based on the special relationship between a student and the school? What do the pleadings in this case tell us about the answer to that question?
I don't know. As the plaintiff indicated, he had some trouble sorting it out, as did I. I don't see it as a premises liability issue, to be honest. I mean, there's nothing, you know, it wasn't a defective swing set, which, you know, doesn't matter when that occurs. That's, you know, that's a different story. It's a third party bringing its dog on there. And they tried to sort of bring it in with that no dogs policy, but there isn't a no dogs policy that exists. So
if the allegations are failure to properly supervise the playground area, failure to properly train staff, failure to monitor students on the playground area.
That strikes me as negligence, Your Honor.
Well, they're both negligent.
Sure.
What's the source of the duty?
It's a matter of how we frame it up.
Sure. And that there is no duty, and that there was no premises liability, in as much as there was not anything that LPS did wrong, as it was a third party. So however it's framed, either LPS had no duty or did nothing wrong.
Is there an order of operations to how we should consider? In this case, the trial court granted summary judgment, both out finding that there was no legal duty of the school and also finding that the discretionary function exemption applied. Is there an order of operations to that decision? Should one be considered before the other?
I think to the extent that there is, I would posit that the duty analysis is conducted first.
Why is that?
Not the immunity analysis?
Well, that's a fair question. If no other reason than just because the district court looked at it first is honestly the way I looked at it. But I assume, as Justice Castle is indicating, if there is immunity, you don't even get to the negligence issue. So I can't disagree with that either, that if indeed there is a determination that we're immune, then you don't get to the negligence duty analysis in the first place. And in theory, immunity should come first, because if a political subdivision is to lose on that issue on summary judgment, that can be appealed directly to the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court. So, you know, under that theory, I certainly think it indicates, as I'll do a complete 180 in about a minute, that, you know, the immunity analysis
certainly could reverse. But on the appealability on immunity, help me out, because maybe I'm behind the times. Are you referring to a recent statute in terms of appealability on immunity?
Yeah, I don't have it. It may be relatively recently amended that indicates that if a political subdivision loses summary judgment on an immunity claim, that that, I believe, is immediately appealable. All right, before I change anything 180 degrees again, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. We have no time for rebuttal, is that correct? That is correct. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is Anderson versus A&R Ag Spraying and Trucking.